First, thanks for everyone for coming. I know it's last day and in the afternoon, so thanks a lot for coming and listening to my talk. So I'm going to talk on interactive querying of strings using Apache Pulsar. So kind of the agenda of my talk here is I'm going to kind of first go over some of the use cases of why it's important to query both your recent streams as well as your historic data. Go over some existing architectures. I'll briefly talk about Apache Pulsar, give an overview. And lastly, I would go over Pulsar SQL and how it really basically helps you in querying both historic recent streams as well as historic streams. And what I really want to save time for is a demo to show you how it all kind of pieces together. I'll briefly talk about some basic concepts like, what is a stream? It's a continuous flow of data. And I would also say most data originate in this form, right? That, there's always some sort of time element involved in, basically, a record or something like that. Not just, 3 terabytes of data happens, just appears on your file system usually all at once, right? It's usually, piece by piece, small, record by record that these things actually happen with a timestamp, right? So what do I mean when I say interactive querying of streams? I really mean, as I hinted before, querying both, the latest as well as, historical data. So how is that useful? Why do I need to really query my recent stuff as well as, old stuff? And if you're here for Julian's talk before, he kind of, hinted on some of that as well. So what I can really see is, speed. That's one of the things in general, not necessarily, querying both recent and historical streams, but that's just like in general for stream processing, that if you're able to process the data faster, the recent data, you can act, on that data faster. And also is accuracy, right? If you're only querying like old data, or delayed data, you might, you might have the wrong impression of the situation. Right, you might be making wrong choices because you don't have the most recent data. For example, if you're using historical data to predict, what a user is interested in buying, but what you don't know is recently the user already bought the data that you will recommend. Why would you recommend that thing again? I mean, we see that all the time in Amazon, and I think it's funny. It's like, well, already just bought this. Why are you recommending to me again, right? So that's kind of a very basic. A very basic argument of why querying both your recent and historic data is relevant, right? And some concrete use cases that I've seen patterns of where it also makes sense is especially for debugging. When I basically, if I have my application log or some sort of system log, and that's basically a stream of data, right? Things happen at a point in time. I get that. How I need to query both not only the old stuff, a day old or whatever, but I also want to look at what the recent stuff is, right? So to predict like, have I seen these errors before? How often, when did I see them, to basically help you debug efficiently. Also a common use case for, the querying both recent and historic is autodebug. Basically answering, if you have some sort of access log or CDC, which I'm going to talk about, like, what was accessed, when, and who, and why, right? And you're looking for these suspicious patterns. And the faster you can act on some of this data, the faster you can prevent some, nefarious activity, right? And this is very, I see this pattern a lot in financial institutions, especially for CDC applications, where, you have basically a CDC change log that's, as a stream, and you really want to be able to dive in and see, when did things happen, and, catch those patterns. Also, is the most basic thing is data exploration. I see a lot in terms of, I have data, my stream data, and maybe batch data, or, historic data. I want to query it, right? I want to see what's in there, explore it a little bit, make sure maybe I'm getting some correct results. And this kind of chimes in to what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk, is if I can do that in one place, that'll make it a lot simpler. But a lot of architectures out there, it's like, well, some of my stuff is in my queue, some of the stuff is in HDFS or in S3. Like, you know, I have to go to kind of multiple places to get that information. And to list some other use cases, you know, data analytics for sure, and all sorts of ways, right? Business intelligence, real-time dashboards that really, you know, brings out the real-time and, you know, and it really emphasizes on, you know, kind of the more recent data as well. So some of the, you know, the stream processing patterns I've noticed before, it kind of summarizes in this diagram is you have data ingestion, right? You know, as I said, things come in as a stream. I have some sort of messaging system, you know, Kafka or whatever, you know, RabbitMQ. Either I pipe it and store that data as raw format, or, you know, I send it out to some compute engine, I enrich it, I filter it, I do whatever, and I write the results, you know, back to storage, and then, you know, I can either query, you know, some of, you know, my data here, or in my messaging queue, there might be some more recent data that's not been, you know, gone through the pipeline. So what that really, you know, to kind of actually implement this kind of paradigm that I see a lot, you know, the existing solutions I've seen people use is, you know, I have a messaging system, it could be all those technologies, real-time compute storage, and then I have some other thing to query it on top, right? And while this, you know, the stack works, there could be some simplification, right? You're running multiple things, data could be here and there. You know, this comes to my, you're running multiple systems, you can have duplication of data. To be honest, like, this diagram is, if you're doing this is already pretty good. Like, if your company or your organization you're at, like, is at least, you know, have this kind of stack, that's pretty good. You're basically saving a lot of space and storage, and that's actually pretty efficient. I've seen much worse situations where you have, you know, not only storage, but you have like another data warehousing solution over here, like Vertica, and then you're also piping, not only you're storing it here, you're also storing it in Vertica, and you get into all sorts of trouble with data consistency, with, you know, well, where is the source of truth? Well, you know, how far off am I from, you know, the source of truth, right? And it gets into a nightmare in that scenario as well. And the last thing is latency between data ingestion when it's queryable. If you have a very deep pipeline, if you have a very complicated pipeline like that, there's going to be delays in some of that, which, you know, it's not beneficial, you know, for you, if especially you want to, you know, use those recent results as well in your query. So this is where Apache Pulsar really comes in and really shines because of its architecture and how we, you know, also you couple with Pulsar SQL. And just to, you know, preface this so that not someone doesn't, you know, a Spark user or anyone or a Flink user comes in and wants to fight me afterwards, is that I'm not saying that you could replace that whole stack I said before with Pulsar. I'm not saying that. I'm just giving some ideas, and there's some use cases in which you can simplify that pipeline, right? I'm not saying Pulsar is a place to do all your processing and you can just come to Pulsar to do, you know, all your stuff. I'm just I'm just presenting some arguments in which you can consolidate your stack and simplify your stack. So since this talk is not really about just an overview of Pulsar, I'm going to briefly go over, you know, the history of Pulsar. I'm going to go, you know, talk about some of the concepts and architecture. I'm going to really emphasize on the architecture pieces that makes, you know, Pulsar SQL relevant and what makes it actually make sense to build this kind of Pulsar SQL on top of, you know, Pulsar. So just some brief history. You know, project started at Yahoo around 2012, you know, open source, yada, 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 graduated, 160 contributors, lot, you know, over 4,100 stars now. As you can see, the star graph are, you know, getting more and more popular. A lot of companies use it. Just provided an example list of companies that are, you know, using Pulsar. So what exactly is Pulsar? I want to get into is Pulsar, I would say, is a flexible messaging plus streaming system backed by a durable log storage. But what you can also think of Pulsar is Event Store, right? Because we have features, it has evolved more than just like a messaging system. Because of its architecture that we'll go over later, it is actually, it makes sense to call Pulsar an event store system. There are other messaging systems out there that are trying to make this claim. I'm not going to name them, but their arguments are relatively weak, I would say, for, you know, positioning themselves as an event store. And as I go over the architecture of Pulsar, it would make it very clear why, you know, Pulsar is, you know, is appropriate to be called, you know, an event store. And I'll go over Pulsar. So basic concepts, right? Pulsar is at its base a messaging kind of system. So you have producers. I write to the channels or topics. I got data in my topics, and then alternatively, I can consume those topics, consume that data from the topics with consumers. I'm gonna briefly go over some of these concepts. Pulsar is multi-tenant. We, you know, organize things in a multi-tenant way for topics and whatnot. So I forgot to ask, like, how many of you guys actually know about Pulsar? Just a raise of hands. Okay, that's pretty good. How many of you, like, actually went to a talk at ApacheCon about Pulsar? Like, there was a couple of previous talks. Okay. So the previous talks went over some of these concepts, so I'll just go over them very quickly. I want to touch up on the architecture of Pulsar, which, you know, makes Pulsar SQL, it makes sense to implement Pulsar SQL on top of Pulsar. So the architecture of Pulsar is layered. We basically separate compute and storage into separate layers. And there's also a function processing layer. It's for, you know, lightweight compute. I won't really touch up on that in this talk because, you know, it's a whole separate issue. But what you really want to take away from here is, you know, we separate message and compute. So what that really means is we can scale those layers separately of each other. And that's very powerful. And the next powerful thing we decided to do is segment-centric storage. So instead of like a partition-centric storage, like, you know, like Apache Kafka, right? We're not storing all of the data within a topic in just one giant chunk on a node. Each topic is broken up into segments, and those segments are sprayed across our storage nodes. Our storage layer, we actually use another Apache project called Apache Bookkeeper. And we store, which is a kind of a durable, we would like to say a durable stream storage project. But the key here is we break up topics into segments and spray them across our storage layer. The obvious benefit of that is improved read performance because we're leveraging more than one node for, you know, these reads, right? And also, if we add another bookie here, right, we can just start adding segments here. There's no really any heavy lifting operations. We don't have to, you know, rebalance and all of that. It just automatically gets added. So because of this segment-centric architecture, we're able to add brokers, which is actually a stateless layer. These are stateless nodes. We're able to dynamically scale our serving layer and our storage layer basically transparently. When we add another node, more data is just being, you know, added on there. Everything is normal. We don't have to, you know, do any sort of expensive operations to move data to this new node. Does that make sense, everyone? Yeah? Okay. And I went over some of that. And also, like, if what you can see, what I also want to talk about is kind of because of that architecture, we can actually, you know, scale storage almost infinitely, right? Which makes it a very good event store story. We can just keep adding storage nodes, and more data is just going to get added on there. We're not bound by any sort of limits like partition size or anything like that. You can actually store data forever or for a very long time. And I'm also going to go over tiered storage, is one of the features we also added to Pulsar, in which you can offload some of your segments to like S3, you know, to another storage system to actually take advantage, to really, you know, give credence to this unlimited log storage story. And just to dive in a little deeper into how it actually works out when you actually write data into Pulsar. So when a producer produces to a broker, to a topic, the broker does a quorum write, essentially, on your ensemble of bookies, which is basically a subset of all your storage nodes. It could be all your storage nodes or a subset of it. But essentially what that really means is, if I want to have three replicas, I will issue out those three writes, but I'll only wait for two acts. I mean, that's a common concept that happens, right? So, you know, it helps with stragglers, essentially, if one is slow. But what this means for SQL and querying the data that's, you know, already in storage is that we can obviously read it out from multiple bookies and take advantage of the, you know, not only the compute but also networking resources of doing these parallel reads, because we have the data written in multiple plates. And what is better is, what is also supported is, if you don't want to take the cost of multiple replicas, you can also stripe the data across all of the bookies in your ensemble. So if you're saying, okay, in this situation, I'm doing basically having a replica count of three, right? Maybe I don't want to take that, you know, I don't want to write it three times. Maybe I only want to write it two times. But I can still take advantage of the networking of all of the three bookies if I just stripe the data across the three storage nodes here, right? To basically take advantage of the network of all of the nodes in my ensemble. There's some bookkeeper internals. I'm not really gonna go over that, but you know, it supports all. It's, you know, you can read more about it on the bookkeeper website. So just to touch up on kind of the difference between, you know, kind of the partition-based architecture and our segment-based architecture. There's a ton of advantages, but just to briefly, you know, show, like I touched before, you know, partitions, they're just basically, you know, files stored on nodes, right? And, you know, there's a lot of not only operational difficulties involved in that kind of architecture, but as well as performance. Especially if we want to do what I'm trying to do is the interactive querying of both historic data and recent data, right? If you have this kind of architecture, you're kind of really limited. Well, I only have the data kind of, you know, in a subset of my nodes, and it's there. And if it's not partitioned, then there's really, you know, disadvantages of me trying to read out that data. Well, in Apache Pulsar, because we're a segment-based architecture, we can, you know, infinitely store stuff as well as take advantage of, you know, multiple nodes, the network resources of multiple nodes.
Does anyone have any questions about all this? Yes.
Just each bookkeep a replicated copy of the data.
Yes. So there's it's like Raft. So that's a whole another presentation I can do on how bookkeeper works and how it replicates data. But yes. So the replication, the writing the replicas in bookkeeper is the responsibility of the writer. So basically, there's a bookkeeper writer and the Apache Pulsar broker that writes replicas to that writes these segments and its replicas to the underlying bookie nodes, and there's guarantees of, you know, that it will. If you're saying you write replica, if you have three replicas, it's going to make sure that you'll have three.
So if you add another bookie, how does it replicate the data over? You said that person.
So. If you add another bookie, it's not going to replicate that data over. You're not making copies. Just new data might be added to that. Does that make sense? And I touched on a concept. Because of our segment-based architecture, it's relatively easy for us to implement something like tier storage. Because our stuff is segment-based, we can just store our segments in S3, you know, GCS, and Azure Cloud Storage, and it's relatively easy. And you can, you know, offload as much as you want. So even if you don't want to scale out your bookies, you can just set up tier storage and it automatically, you know, offloads it to, you know, S3 or all the other, you know, cloud storage services, and, you know, you'll have kind of infinite retention. As much as you obviously want to pay for.
So these are concrete destination or where they get stored. Is it possible to do layering where some of them could be in memory and maybe get pushed down to physical location?
So one of the reasons why Pulsar, the performance of Pulsar is as it is because there's actually a lot of caching involved. Not to dive in too deep into Apache Bookkeeper and internals of the broker. So Pulsar really, to answer your question, I kind of want to go over the operations you normal, the pattern access times you normally see in something like a messaging system. Right? You have writes, right, producing. You have reads, and then you have tailing reads. But you have tailing reads, and then you have catch up reads, right? So when a producer comes in and produces to a broker, that message is actually cached in memory, right? The broker is also going to write it to the storage layer, but it's actually there's a cache within here. So if your consumer is basically not falling behind, the message that will be served to the consumer will just be read from in memory and then delivered to the consumer for that low latency. But if you're really behind, then we're going to start reading from Bookkeeper, and Bookkeeper is basically a log structured merge tree, if you kind of understand that concept. There's all sorts of caches in Bookkeeper that the likelihood of you reading your data from memory is very high, because for a single read, it's going to bring a ton of data into memory, and your subsequent reads will be from memory as well.
And we can, if you have, yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah. So the sizes of all these caches, whether it's in the broker, whether it's in the bookie, those are all configurable. And you need to configure them based on what kind of workload, what kind of performance you want. Talked about tier storage, and also to go over that schema registry is built into Pulsar as well, so that all the data within your Pulsar clusters, stored on your storage layer, is basically structured. Of course, you don't have to, it can also just be bytes, but because we want to be able to query it using SQL, obviously it has to be structured. So, if you want your data to be structured and stored that way, that is gonna be, that is natively supported in Pulsar as well. There's a ton of other features, Pulsar, that I'm not really gonna touch up on because it's not really the focus of my talk, but I encourage you to read up more about it. I'll have some more links at the end of my talk. So let's really get into kind of Pulsar SQL. Pulsar SQL, we built it because it's a obvious use case that users, once they store data, produce data into a topic, and especially if it's a lot of data, because Pulsar can support a lot of data within your topic. Well, how do I kind of just like look inside, right? That's kind of the first thing. How do I just look inside and see what I have in there, right? Of course, I can read all of the data out using a consumer, but that's not very efficient, because producing and consuming, that workflow is really optimized for latency, right? What we really want to do for querying all your data is optimizing for throughput, right? And to talk a little bit more about Pulsar SQL, what we did is we built a connector for Presto that's able to read the data in our storage layer. So just to go over a little bit about Presto, Presto is a distributed query engine. It's basically just an engine. It doesn't have storage, so you can basically, it's just an execution engine. It doesn't make any assumptions about how you read that data. But what it does support is it's fully ANSI. It supports full ANSI SQL. So any sort of in that standard, you'll be able to execute those queries on your data that's stored in Pulsar. I went over some of that, but one of the things I also want to touch up on is
it is our Pulsar SQL that we implement on top of Presto can also read data from basically off of the storage in S3. So no matter if it's stored on the storage nodes or offloaded in some other fashion, you're able to query all of that data. And because of our architecture, it is a many-to-many read, right? Because, as I mentioned before, once you write data to a topic, the actual data is our segments that are spread across multiple nodes. So even if I don't have multiple partitions, if I just have a single topic, my throughput will still be pretty good because I'm utilizing multiple nodes to read that data out. And by default, you know, because of how data is organized in Bookkeeper, segments also time, everything is time, we have time-based indexing. So what that really means in SQL, in the SQL context, is if you have a predicate, right, that's basically say, well, this is a start time, this is an end time, I want to do some sort of query between that time, we're able to just fetch the data between that time to really increase the performance and not have to, let the query engine filter out all, the junk data that's, not fit into that window. So this is kind of the architecture in a bird's view, right? I'm my producers, I'm writing segments. Those segments could be in my bookies. Usually that's kind of like the, you can think about as hot storage, right? That's the more recent data. And your more historic data could be offloaded into one of, the tier storage. But with, Pulsar SQL, you're able to read all of that data out with high throughput. Does that kind of make sense? Does anyone have any questions? So just to elaborate more, hammer home the benefits. Because Pulsar has an independent storage layer and Pulsar is really kind of an event storage system, in a sense, you don't really need to move data into another system for querying. If you're already using Pulsar and that data is coming into Pulsar, you don't need to necessarily dump it somewhere else to query it. You can use Pulsar SQL to query that data that's within your topics. And this is kind of a narrative we're really trying to push is instead of shoving your data into, a data lake or, some sort of data warehouse as your, as your source of truth, maybe consider using Pulsar, right? Because Pulsar, you have these storage benefits. Pulsar could be your single storage solution, and you can basically store all your data there, and that will be your source of truth. And the performance, like I hinted before, is not impacted by partitioning because we're not a partition-based architecture; we're a segment-based architecture. So, if you want to tune the performance of your reads for Pulsar SQL, you could easily do that by increasing the number of either the replicas you write to or the number of nodes in your ensemble, so you're striping the data across more nodes to really increase the parallelism of your reads. Yes?
Is SQL Worker a separate node or is it running
the Worker? It is a separate node. Underneath, it's basically a Presto worker. We've done some packaging and stuff like that, so we have made things easier for you to kind of start a Presto cluster alongside your Pulsar cluster. But at the end of the day, it is basically a Presto cluster that is querying your Pulsar cluster. Does that make sense? So if you already have a Presto cluster, obviously you can just take the connector and start reading data from Pulsar to begin with. So because of this architecture, when you have new data that's being produced, because when a producer produces data to the broker, we have all sorts of durability guarantees. But usually what happens is the broker will immediately write it to the bookies, and that data is f-synced. And immediately after that, that data is queryable, which implicates that all the data that you've successfully produced, which means you got like an ACK back from your producer got an ACK back from the broker, that's queryable by Pulsar SQL. We've done some performance testing, but this is obviously we continue to try to improve the performance. I'll have a future work slide about some of the ways we're trying to improve the performance as well. But we have done some initial performance testing on three nodes. We're able to get about around 60 million rows a second for JSON if it's compressed, and about 50 million rows a second if it's Avro compressed. Yes?
Are these read or write performance tests?
So for Presto, all the kind of access patterns for Presto is gonna impulse our SQL. These are reads. We don't do any sort of writes.
Oh.
Right. We don't do any writes from Presto, from Pulsar SQL into this data. So you're using this to basically query the data that you already have.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
I see.
Sorry if that was not clear. So the next thing I want to show you is... Yes.
Why do you need so much memory, 128 gigabytes? Most of it is persistent, huh?
Hmm?
Most of it
Yes. But obviously, if you have more memory, you can cache more data in memory. So that's a reason, if you're able to do that, it improves your performance.
Of course, then you're just hitting memory. You're not really going through the entire pipeline.
But if your data is more than 128 gigs, then of course it is better.
Of course.
Obviously, you don't need that much resources on your nodes. It can run on much smaller machines. But there's definitely implications of performance. If you do have a lot of memory, utilize it, because the Pulsar and the bookies are able to basically cache more of that data, bring more of that data into memory to improve performance. Yes.
Well, what are the minimum requirements for running it?
For running it?
Yeah.
That depends on how much performance you want, right? Like, you could run it with one core and 1 gig of memory, and it would still work. But it might be the queries you run might be very slow, but if you don't have a lot of data, that might be good enough, right? Like, it doesn't, or if basically a lot of your data is offloaded into S3, you might not need that. On those three nodes, we're running brokers and bookies as well. So it's kind of also those resources are shared among those components as well as the Presto workers we're running.
Okay.
But you can definitely configure a smaller cluster, which I'm actually going to show you. In the demo, I don't have a cluster of this size. This is just for seeing how far we can push it. But the actual cluster I'm going to use for the demo is actually much smaller. Yes.
So if the data is on S3, so for querying part, the data first need to be transferred from S3 to local.
To where? To local?
Yeah.
Yes. So it's not gonna be like stored in bookies first. We're gonna read it directly. So the SQL worker will read it directly from S3. We're not storing it locally anywhere. We're loading it directly through the network from S3.
But if the query needs to apply any filter or looping thing, then first it needs to be brought from S3 to the worker home.
Yes, in memory. It usually is in memory. Yep. So I'm gonna give a neat demo here of kind of orchestrating this whole sentiment analysis pipeline in Pulsar. So I'm gonna run a Pulsar source, a Twitter source that basically injects tweets into a tweet topic, and then from there, I'm gonna use a Pulsar function, which is this thing, think about it as a lightweight compute, as a kind of a serverless function that basically reads in these tweets and classifies them as either a positive tweet, a neutral tweet, or a negative tweet. It also, we have state for functions, so you can do some sort of stateful processing, but I'm not gonna really go over that. But in a sense, you can also keep count of how many positive tweets I've seen, neutral tweets I've seen, or negative tweets I've seen. But at the end of the day, this function is gonna basically classify the tweet into positive, neutral, and negative. And then we can use Pulsar SQL to kind of look at the results and see what kind of tweets we have seen so far. So let me first exit out of this. And is it this way? So I work for a company called Streamlio, and we provide a SaaS offering called Pulsar. So we built a little cool UI here to help you, use Pulsar. But everything I'm going to demonstrate here, you can do in open source. Just it'll be through a command line and not necessarily through a graphical interface. So the first thing I'm going to do here, actually, what will make this really easy, give me a second, is if I mirror my screen. Sorry, give me 1 second here. There we go. Right. Oh. So, when you log into kind of our cloud offering, it will bring you to this page, and it gives you some statistics about the overall usage of the user in our cluster. But what you can do is I can come here. I can create a source to inject data into it. Let's just call it Twitter, and we'll do it. And then you would enter the API keys you need for such, and then I have, wait, where is, give me 1 second here. There we go. So I have some sample keys that you could just enter here. I just do this really fast. I don't know why Twitter has, you have so many keys that you need for just getting the data. It's beyond me. So I can create it. So you can also do this in open source, but it'll just be through a command line. We just have created a graphical interface for you to do it in our cloud offering. So after you create it, and just to touch up on connectors, pulsar functions, these are things that can actually be run in the cluster. So you don't have to, even in just pure open source, you don't have to basically orchestrate, figure out how to run them yourselves. The cluster will figure out how to run it within the cluster. So I've started it. Let's make sure it starts up here. We can obviously look at the logs. Seems like it's going. This is how you know it's a live demo, because I'm not even sure what's good. I mean, I've run this before, but all sorts of things could happen, right? Twitter could be down, all sorts of things. But as you can start seeing here, we are starting to get messages. And we can inspect, we are starting to get tweets. Now let's run the function. I can create a function here. We've, created this nice UI to be able to, create a function. What is also cool is, I'm not really going to go over this, but you can just inline the Python function, and it will basically, you can just submit it from the text box here, and it'll actually run in the cluster and execute your logic. But the function I have written is actually in Java. So I've added the input topics. I have a URL for the function, and then if you want to know more about pulsar functions, it's something I kind of didn't cover. It's going to be covered in another talk, I think right after this one, by CJ over there. So stick around for that. Pulsar functions are really cool. But just think about it as, a way to do computing within pulsar. That's, if you're already using pulsar, you can use that to do some lightweight compute. Give some resources. I'm going to create that. So this function is actually pretty large, because it contains a model to do the classifying based on sentiment. It's going to take a couple of seconds here to load that into the cluster. So it's successfully created. I can go here. Eventually, once the function starts running, we will see the input topics and kind of the output topics here visually. And to give you kind of a better understanding, let's look at the logs, make sure it's running. Yep. Now we have, you can see all the topics. Like, okay, we have a negative tweet, neutral tweets, and positive tweets, as well as the original tweet topic. We go back to the function. So this is kind of our pipeline that we've created, right? We have our tweets. We have our function that does the classification. And now we have, the three topics that we kind of, separated, classified the tweets into. While I can't just have consumers, to read all the data out for one reason or another, If I want to look at all of the stuff, all the negative tweets I've done, all the neutral tweets, all the positive tweets, what is really cool is the SQL, I'm not sure, I guess the screen, that we've implemented as well. And this is kind of a way for me to demo Pulsar SQL. Is I can, for example, let's first look at, you know, explore my cluster. Let me pull this up further. This is kind of the, here, does that show the whole? Yeah, there we go. So as you can see, I can just say what tables, which really just map to topics that I have within my, you know, namespace, within my area. Pulsar is multi-tenant, things are divided up. This is what I'm assigned to for, you know, for in the cluster. It's under Jerry default. And you can see kind of, you know, I got my negative tweets, neutral tweets, positive tweets, and the original tweet topic. What I can also do is, you know, maybe I just want to explore your data, right? That's one of the use cases. I can run it on the tweet topic, and here are all the tweets. These are actually live tweets, right? We're getting right now. So I don't know, there could be bad language or inappropriate content, just to pretend. So these are the live tweets. I can explore the data and whatnot in Pulsar SQL like this. And to do some, you know, other fun queries, for example, you know, I can do some aggregation, count how many tweets I've, you know, seen so far, you know, because I started it relatively, you know, I didn't not that long ago. I only have 640, but if I run it again, that number increases. You guys, let me, it's kind of being cut off here. So if I run it again, as you can see, it keeps on, you know, growing and growing, you know, to how as much retention as you want, right? And the last query I want to show, it's kind of a fun query. Let's just say, you know, based on the tweets, how many times is our president mentioned, you know, in positive, neutral, or negative tweets. It's something fun to run to see, you know, what people are saying online, obviously, you know. So actually, because we don't have that much data, I searched for Trump, right, the name, and then there's, you know, so far I've seen zero positive tweets, five neutral tweets, and negative tweets. But as you run the data, as you get more and more data, those results will eventually change, right? And you know, in a previous life, I worked at a financial institution, and this is literally, you know, one of the pipelines we had, one of the signals we needed to generate is something like this, right? Based on, how does people feel about our president? You know, is it mostly positive today, mostly neutral today, is it negative today? And that's one of the signals we actually send into our trading system, like based on, well, you know, maybe people are confident about our government, then the stock is going to go up to some certain extent, right? Like, while, you know, contrast to the difference in what we were doing and, you know, in my previous job is to do something like this, it was a very complicated pipeline. Like, it was a lot of, you know, custom batch jobs we wrote here and we dump it somewhere else and then we have a cron job to run it, you know, periodically. It was a mess. Like, as you can see, I ran this whole pipeline in, like, you know, a couple of minutes I was able to just do this, and it just made things, you know, having Pulsar SQL with Pulsar makes this kind of stuff, like, super simple. And that's it for the demo. I have a couple more slides here as we run out of time. So we actually have a real use case for Pulsar SQL here at Zhaoping, which is kind of a Chinese equivalent of LinkedIn and Indeed. They're actually using Pulsar SQL to do some analytics. Zhaoping already uses Pulsar to do a lot of its ingestion as a message bus. So a lot of the job searches and the search params and search results are the records dumped into Pulsar, and they're going to use Pulsar SQL to do some analysis on user behavior and how, you know, what a user is searching is related to, you know, what jobs they're, you know, potentially going to apply. So that's a, you know, an actual, a concrete use case of, you know, Pulsar SQL in the wild, as you would say. Future work, briefly go over that. You know, we're constantly looking to make Pulsar SQL more performant, right? We have a really good foundation, as I hope, you know, I explained that to you very well. But in the future, we're going to do more performance tuning. You know, store data, perhaps. Currently, you can think about data being stored in a row format, but we're looking to see if we can somehow store data in a columnar format, especially the data that's offloaded into, you know, S3 or in shared storage, because at that point, you're not really looking for latency in terms of your reads, you're really looking for throughput. So maybe if we change the data, the format of the data, we can get better, better not only compression, but also read, throughput if it's in a columnar format. And currently, as I mentioned before, we are kind of indexed by publish time. So our primary index you can think about is by default publish time. But in the future, we are looking to see if we can support some other types of other indexes in the data. So if you have a different or user custom index that you want to basically use in your predicate, maybe we will think of something to make that query more efficient for you. And I briefly kind of touched about Apache Pulsar. There's a whole a bunch of stuff about Apache Pulsar. I can talk for we can talk for days about the nitty-gritty details. Here's a great book published by one of my coworkers, David, right there. Feel free to talk to him. That goes over a ton of stuff. So check it out. Also check out we at Streamlio we've written a ton of tutorials and blogs that have some great information. But if you don't care about any of that, at least join the Apache Slack community channel to just ask questions and just talk to us. We have like 1,100 users now, so on Slack. So feel free, just join our community there. Do I have any more slides? Questions here. My email address. Encourage you to try Apache Pulsar yourself. A really easy way to try it is to come and sign up for the sandbox. It's free. You'll get a user. You can kind of play around with Pulsar, via our SaaS via our SaaS service of Apache Pulsar. You can just sign up, and then you can produce and consume to our SaaS service, and you can kind of really play around with Pulsar without having to kind of set up the cluster yourself in that way. So I encourage you to sign up in our cloud service and start playing with Pulsar to kind of understand it better. Here's some extra slides, but that's all I have. Any questions about what I've talked about or Pulsar in general, I guess? Yes.
So if I understand correctly, the SQL queries have to go through the whole stream of data. Like if the data is going to be huge,
yes.
Will it have to process all of that, or is there a way to look at only the final state? Like a table?
Okay, so I actually had a slide about how it's like different than streaming SQL and what Julian kind of talked about in the previous talk, right? So for that's what is different about Pulsar SQL. Pulsar SQL is just looking at the raw data. It's not looking at kind of it's not going to be generating some sort of final view of a table. If you look at if your log is kind of like is a table that keeps getting updates, you can use Pulsar SQL to query that data, and you'll get all those updates, but it's not there to basically give you the view of what that final table will look like. Does that make sense? You'll still see all the updates, as in, okay, the value of this key is 5 at this point, and at a later time, it's 6, right? You can still see those updates, but it's not going to compact it for you into the final table by itself. Yes?
I think you explained this before, but mm-hmm. just to confirm,
yes.
Can you just plug it into your Kafka stream and not store it per se, but be able to query the stream bandwidth?
So the thing with Kafka, doing this in Kafka is, and this is actually how they implemented this, is they're really reading the data out using consumers, right? And that paradigm is really good. Is optimized for latency. It's not optimized for throughput. So if you have a lot of data, sure, if you don't have that much data, all right, but if you do have that much data, you're gonna have a lot of performance problems. Your queries are gonna take forever. And even for Kafka SQL, how much stuff you can join is really limited because those are individual applications, essentially. And Kafka SQL is not really for querying all of historic data. It's mostly for basically querying the latest data that's arrived and it's going to window it for you. But it's not really there for querying all the data within your topic system.
Sure.
And also because of Kafka's architecture, right? If you have partitions and you have a single topic, and you have, I don't know, a couple partitions are replicated, at most you can probably read it from, well, actually you can only probably, if you have a single partition, you can only kind of read it from one node, right? You can only consume from one node. Well, in Pulsar SQL, because of our architecture, when we go directly to read from the storage layer, we can do these basically parallel reads, right? Which really increases the performance. And that's really kind of, you know, why it doesn't really make sense to do something like this in Kafka. You can, but like, there's a lot of performance implications of trying to do that within Kafka because of that architecture, partition-based architecture. Yes?
For example, it is a predicate in the query. The predicate should be pushed down to your storage nodes, right?
Yep.
Potentially reduce data transfer.
Yep. So that's the whole idea of, you know, maybe we offload or write our data in Parquet, especially in tiered storage. Or even on the bookies, you know, how we can, you know, optimize storage there as well. But obviously, if it's on bookies, you got to worry about the tailing read situation. It's not just, you know, for, you know, batch reads, these batch reads that you want to really look for throughput, right? But there's a lot of research that can go into that. And currently, like I said before, we have a predicate pushdown for publish time, right? Because data is already organized in Bookkeeper in terms of publish time. If you have a predicate saying between, if I want data between, you know, X and Y time, really we can read the data and return that data to the Presto execution engine of, you know, basically of messages just within that time. So it's not gonna, you know, it reduces basically the number of messages you have to read to run your query. But in the future, like I said, we'll try to support more indexes, different indexes, to improve performance. Yes?
So, with respect to the functions in Pulsar, so the function which you deploy is running in the broker, right?
I would encourage you to stick around for the next talk from CJ that he'll talk more about this. But functions, it can be run in the broker as a thread, it can be run as a process. And in my scenario here, we're actually running Pulsar on Kubernetes. So, a function is actually basically a stateful set in Kubernetes, which is actually, you know, a pod. You know, running in my Kubernetes cluster. So there's multiple ways you could run your Pulsar function, right? Which really contrasts with KSQL, because KSQL, like, yeah, or KStrings, you kind of run that yourself somewhere and figure out how to parallelize it and whatnot. And Pulsar functions, one of the design choices we had is to make that easy. Like, the developer shouldn't be needing to know how to run my application in a fault-tolerant way. So the cluster takes care of that. You submit a Pulsar function to be run in the Pulsar cluster, and an admin, a cluster admin, right, will configure a cluster and determine, well, should I run it as a process, should I run it in a Docker container, should I run it as a thread? You know, that's more of a cluster admin's job to figure that out. Well, the developer, you know, I just want to execute some logic on my stream of data, right? And so the developer will just submit the Pulsar function to be run, you know, in the cluster in a fault-tolerant manner. Any other questions? Well, thanks everyone for coming. Try Apache Pulsar. Support us on, if you do nothing, go start our project on GitHub.